Support for IPR comes from Corridor Vein Center and Corridor Aesthetics, treatment for varicose veins and spider veins, also providing facial rejuvenation services and treatment for moderate to severe acne. More at Corridor Vein and CorridorAesthetics.com.
You're listening to an archive edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Well, let's start by having me mention one word and see what images and events pop into your mind. Here's your word. Conspiracy. What comes to mind for you? A fake moon landing? Wild ideas about Elvis being still alive, perhaps? Or Bigfoot? What about in the political arena? The assassination of JFK, of course, has to come to mind. What about the so-called Red Scare of the 20th century? Now, conspiracy theories and their believers abound, and they have throughout U.S. history, going way back to colonial times. So in today, in the 21st century, we know misinformation, disinformation, unfounded conspiracies have become more and more intractable. And the increased fragmentation of our news in our digital era make some solutions there hard to come by. This hour, we want to really dig into the psychology behind conspiracy theories throughout history, this radicalization, the moral panics, and examine just how dangerous a lie can become once it spreads like wildfire. Joining us, we like to call them the two Tims. Tim Walch is a presidential historian. We've had him, and we love to have him on our airwaves as often as possible. Director Emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Tim Walch, welcome back to our studio. Nice to see your face.
Nice to see you, Ben.
Tim Naftali is with us, joining us from New York, I assume, presidential historian, founding director of the Richard Nixon Presidential Library. He's an associate professor of history and public policy at New York University. Tim Naftali, New York Tim, as we refer to you. Welcome back.
Thank you, Ben. Actually, today I'm speaking from the FDR Presidential Library.
Where is that located?
That's in Hyde Park, New York.
Very good. Well, glad to have you with us. Tim Walch, you're going to be covering more of the early history of conspiracy theories in U.S. history. And Tim Naftali, we're going to lean on you as we get into the 20th century and into the present time a little bit more. Tim Walch, before we travel back in time, let's make sure we know what some of the traits are, characteristics that we'll find in all the conspiracy theories that we explore this hour.
It is true, Ben, that conspiracies are a long-standing American tradition, and they do have commonalities. They tend to be a concern about secret plans to deprive people of their rights, deprive innocent people of their rights or their property. There's a general tension between certain groups that make one group suspicious of the other, and that there's a plot or an effort to take away something, that people are scheming to take that away. And it often happens in periods of crisis. So during the Revolutionary period, for example, or even in the late 17th century in Salem, Massachusetts, where you had tension between social classes. But then it goes up through the 19th century and on. There's friction between people who have different religions often. There was an apprehension, for example, about Catholics or Mormons. Social classes, we're concerned about all these immigrants coming in. Could they be trusted? Would they be loyal Americans? So that sort of sense of tension and frustration and concern. And in most cases with conspiracies, emotion tends to trump reason. Mm. People are making decisions based on their fears or their concerns without really gathering facts.
Yeah, and as we know today, you said emotions, people believe what they believe. You can present them with a number of facts that discount their belief. They will most often go on believing.
Well, and we'll talk about this, the whole idea of feedback loops or closed kind of silo thinking. Well, think back even to the 18th century, where people listened and depended upon the minister in their pulpit who told them kind of what to believe. And if that person happened to have a prejudicial view or a conspiratorial view, often that meant the rest of the congregation did. So you have this closed loop without any additional information.
Mm-hmm. Take us back to the early days even before the founding of our country, because we mentioned the Salem witch trials. That's one of the best known ones. But there are numerous other examples that we can take from the colonial period or the revolutionary period. What jumps out in your mind?
Well, several things. For example, there was really from the beginning of the establishment of the colonies, the English colonies, an apprehension about what indigenous peoples, the native tribes were doing, what sort of plots they were scheming against these new establishments, these colonial towns. And so you have within all those colonial towns, fear of Native Americans. In the South, you have almost from 1619 on, but certainly through the 18th and 19th centuries, a real apprehension about slave rebellion and slave revolt, the whole question of whether or not there would be an uprising that could lead to that kind of a tension. It's also true in the 18th century, as the colonial governments evolved in those colonies, there was tension between what was going on in Parliament and what was going on in the colonies. And the colonists were apprehensive that their rights and liberties were going to be deprived of them. And in fact, of course, it leads to our independence. One of the most notable is the Quebec Act. This was the result of the war, French and Indian War in the 1750s and 60s, and it was really an effort by Parliament to reestablish an order for the operation of Canada, which in effect had been predominantly French, and allowing the French to practice their Catholic religion. Well, rumors spread into the colonies that Parliament was going to force all of the colonists to convert to Catholicism. And so you have tension within colonies that spread, again, by ministers throughout that time period. So right up through the establishment of our country, we were dealing with lots and lots of various conspiracies, people taking away their rights. And again, it was in this loop. It was often pulpits, people using pamphlets, word of mouth, and that sort of thing. So how the information was spread, who was spreading it, were just as important as the ideas themselves. Often a kernel of truth, but then it got way out of control.
Mm-hmm. Tim Naftali, let me go to you in New York and ask you about, well, some of your beginning thoughts on these types of unfounded conspiracies early in our history and as we sort of trace our way into more modern times.
Well, as ever, Tim has laid the foundation for us to have a great conversation. Feedback loops, people in your community you respect, these are all important building blocks to understand how conspiracy theories can develop. One element of the story, I think, also is that reality is confusing. It's complicated. And at the heart of many conspiracy theories is a simple explanation, usually a single factor explanation for a complex reality and a complex outcome. A single simple culprit is looked for if a particularly shocking event has happened, an assassination or an attack, because it was unexpected, because the citizen didn't expect it, he or she might look for a simple explanation for why it happened. It isn't simply group dynamics that produce or have produced conspiracies. It's cultural or ethnic group dynamics. It's also a question of power. Americans, while revering the founding fathers, often had real skepticism about elites. And some American conspiracy theories had to do with a sense that there was this concentration of power, whether the concentration was in trusts or in banks, and that these concentrated power centers were working against the interests of the people. So you have sort of many different forms of a conspiracy, but they do share similar characteristics, and one is a sort of a simple explanation for a complex reality. Another is sort of trying to find blame, trying to be able to blame them, another group, for the difficulties of your reality. Those you can see One of the things I hope that Tim and I will discuss is whether conspiracy theories wax and wane in American history. In other words, are there periods where they're way more pronounced? One would argue that we're in one right now, and periods when they're less dominant in popular culture. And why is that? So we might talk about that as we go through some of the more significant episodes of conspiracy thinking in our history.
I'm Ben Kiefer. More after a short break. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to an archive edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Digging this hour into the psychology behind conspiracy theories, the sociology, you could say, as well, throughout U.S. history, and examining how dangerous lies can be once they spread, why they're spread, what parts of history lend themselves to the spread of conspiracy theories. And of course, because we live in a time of extreme misinformation and disinformation, what do these past instances in history have to do with our own times? Joining us, Tim Naftali, presidential historian, joining us from the FDR Presidential Library in Hyde Park in New York today. Tim Walsh is with us in our Iowa City studio. Let's concentrate on, go back to the 19th century, if we could, Tim Walsh, and talk us, note some of the, in the 1800s, some of the notable conspiracy theories people, Americans, would have lived through.
As Tim has suggested, periods wax and wane. That period from 1820 to 1860, a period where there's abolitionism as well as anti-immigrant feelings. There was the evolution of religion, the Mormon religion. Joseph Smith evolved and mm-hmm. began to move west. And in fact, people were apprehensive about Smith and his groups. What were their intentions? And in fact, Smith himself was killed, I think, obviously because of ignorance in the process. So you have, particularly in that period before the Civil War, real tension, and in fact, it's pushed on by conspiracies.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Sorry.
I just want to dig down a little bit on this waxing and waning, because we definitely feel that it has grown in recent years. What makes Tim Naftali? What makes a soil fertile in history? And tell us about the past of that come to mind for you. Past instances. When are we more open to conspiracy theories that are baseless?
Thank you, Ben. Well, when you have a period of rapid social change, whether that change is caused by immigration, as Tim mentioned, different new groups of different religions, when you have a shock to an established system, as, for example, as abolitionism began to challenge the structure of white supremacy and segregation and slavery in the South. Within the South, you saw this gave rise to fear that there would be change, the system of slavery might disappear. We've had political in the 19th century. There were American political parties that were actually founded on a conspiracy theory. There was an anti-Masonic party. Indeed, the former president, I believe, Millard Fillmore, was the national candidate. This was after his time in office. Was the national candidate, the presidential candidate for the anti-Masonic party, and that was founded
its organizing principle was a conspiracy theory about Masons. The Greenback Party, well, it was founded on a set of ideas about soft money, about printing more money, about but it also was founded in a set of assumptions about banks and the sort of the heinous objectives of banks. It, arguably, Andrew Jackson, whose political career was not founded on a conspiracy, it was founded on his desire to be president. But the imagery that he used and some of his arguments about the elites relied on an assumption about the bank, in this case, the Bank of America of the United States, and the sense that you had sort of this octopus of power coming from the bank. So in the 19th century, conspiracies were useful tools to get people, those who were allowed to vote, to get people to the polls. Mm-hmm. So that it wasn't simply fringe groups that were using conspiracy. There were actually major players in American politics who appealed to voters using the language of conspiracy in the 19th century.
If you just joined us, historians Tim Naftala joining us from New York, Tim Walsh in our Iowa City studio. We're looking at conspiracy theories, baseless conspiracy theories throughout U.S. history, and then we're going to tie them into the present time. In the 5 minutes before we have to take a break, let's jump, put our feet into the 20th century and go to a conspiracy theory. A baseless conspiracy that affected the lives of people, perhaps even listening right now, will have a living memory of the so-called Red Scare. Tim Walsh, walk us through the basics of what happened in the middle of the 20th century.
Well, in effect, what we're talking about here, because we're going to listen, I think, to some audio from the McCarthy hearings, was the fear after World War II that the Communist Party of the United States, but also the kind of the Soviet Union, was trying to steal our atomic secrets and that there were spies and traitors among us. McCarthy feasted on this, making undocumented accusations of untold numbers of spies in the State Department. And eventually he got caught up, of course. He had used the medium of newspapers and radio very effectively, but he got caught up in a way when, in fact, the hearings in the 1950s, early televised hearings, caught him in using lies and other misinformation. But I also want to harken back to the fact that Red Scare is a term we often use for a period of insurrection in the years immediately after the First World War, where we were suspicious again of the evolution of the Communist Party in the early days of the Soviet Union. And Mitchell Palmer, the attorney general, conducted red raids, literally trying to root out all of these communists and others. So as Tim has mentioned, we look for these power sources and we look to root them out. And in fact, powerful and in some cases unscrupulous people use that information to gain personal power. So we see it in various people throughout the 20th century.
Let's go to some archive audio from the mid-1950s. Joseph Welch served as the chief counsel for the U.S. Army while it was under the investigation for communist activities by Senator Joe McCarthy, his Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, known as the Army-McCarthy hearings. Now, Welch's confrontation with McCarthy during the hearings seen as a turning point. That's what we want to listen to right here, an excerpt from that turning point, in this instance taken from the 2020 PBS documentary, McCarthy.
Let us not assassinate this lad further, Senator.
You've done
enough. Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency?
Have you no sense of decency? Those are words that we remember. Tim Naftali, comment on that, because it seems to me, not having lived through this time, that it's perhaps atypical for a conspiracy to be ended this way by being called out. I mean, people would, I think many people listening would wish that unfounded conspiracies today could be called out and stopped in a similar fashion. Or is, well, yeah.
In 1964, which was, of course, 10 years later, during the 64 campaign, presidential campaign, Barry Goldwater, who was the Republican nominee, had the support of the John Birch Society, which was a far-right group that feasted on conspiracies about the role of communists in American society, and also included in, you know, among their favorite conspiracies, some vicious anti-Semitic conspiracies, particularly the one regarding the fact that, there was a secret cabal of Jews that directed international finance. That, by the way, that conspiracy theory was created by the Russian intelligence service, the Okhrana, in the 19th century, as a way of encouraging Russians to kill Jews in the pogroms. The Russian government sponsored this, created it out of whole cloth. Anyway, this theory, which had adherents in the United States, among whom were Henry Ford of the Ford Company, this theory was still, it wasn't popular, but it was shared by some members of who were supporting Barry Goldwater. A bipartisan group in the U.S. Senate had hearings about this libelous conspiracy theory to kill it. Imagine if we had a bipartisan hearing to kill the QAnon theory. They did in 1964 about the Zionist conspiracy that the Russian state, not the Soviets, this is the Russian state that had created in the 19th century. So we have actually had in our history, sadly not in our recent history, bipartisan efforts to put to bed these vicious, poisonous conspiracies that tear us apart.
I wanted to jump to an area that I know Tim Naftali, well, both of you know a great deal about, but I think Tim Naftali, you're writing a book now about Kennedy. We know Kennedy was shot in 1963 in Dallas when he was part of a motorcade. Did Lee Harvey Oswald act alone? Was there a second gunman on the grassy knoll? These questions have given rise to a vast arena of conspiracy theories, endless speculation, hundreds of books, articles, and films. Let's listen back to some archive audio. In November of 63, just a couple of days after Lee Harvey Oswald was accused of the assassination of then-President Kennedy, Jack Ruby shot Oswald, killing him. This is from the Today Show of that time, NBC Washington correspondent Martin Agronsky discussing the murder here. Let's listen.
In the basement of the courthouse, policemen, reporters, and cameramen were waiting for Oswald to come down an elevator there to the right to be transferred to another jail. A man named Ruby was waiting, too. The scene began with the familiar routine of news coverage of public events. The officers come down. There goes Ruby toward Oswald. He's firing. Oswald slumps to the floor. And as he does, the police officers beside him leap upon Ruby, as we now know him.
Tim
to
Naftali,
be,
tell us, sort out a fact from fiction here.
The confusion had sorted itself
hard,
out.
You know,
throw him to the ground.
After this passage of time, why we need to say fact and fiction here. Is there any doubt what happened in this assassination?
Well, there's no doubt in my mind that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone wolf. He was a lone assassin. Despite the fact that he would tell the Dallas police that he was a patsy, there is no plausible conspiratorial explanation for his actions. I say that because there are a lot of very interesting conspiracies that have been floated: the mafia, Cubans, the Soviets, some sort of central elite national security group. But if you walk down the story of Lee Harvey Oswald and John F. Kennedy, and you see how these two men's paths sadly crossed in Dallas, not one of those theories explains.
Okay, we have to take a break. We'll be back with the two Tims, Tim Naftali from New York, Tim Walz, our two presidential historians, talking about conspiracy theories, tying in all these kinds of political, non-political things. We're focusing on the political arena in this case, but, you know, all kinds of conspiracies. It's an American tradition, as it turns out, and we'll discuss it more when we come back. Ben Kiefer with historians Tim Walz and Tim Naftali. It's River to River from IPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Back with more River to River and our conversation from November of 2022 on conspiracy theories. I was joined by presidential historians Tim Naftali and Tim Walz. We jump back in with the JFK assassination conspiracy theories. I asked Tim Naftali why these theories are so long-lasting.
Well, part of it is the episode that we just listened to. The fact that the president's assassin is killed in the parking lot of the Dallas police raised so many red flags for Americans. The other part is a more complex explanation, but I think it's really important, which is that in the 20th century, America acquires a national security complex as a result of entering World War II and then taking on huge global responsibilities after the end of World War II. The United States decided to have a permanent intelligence community. This was something that the U.S. had not had, despite being a great power, arguably, since the end of the 19th century. The United States didn't have one. With intelligence communities, you get secrets, and those secrets are kept from the American people, despite the fact that we're in a democracy. I would argue that you need an intelligence community, but one of the unintended consequences of a national security state is deeper skepticism among people because they don't know everything their government is doing. So I believe part of the reason why the Kennedy assassination has been ripe for conspiracy thinking is that it came at the height of the Cold War. It involved a presidency that was engaged in a lot of secret activity abroad, and it involved the death of a beloved figure who actually has become even more loved in retrospect than he was even at the time.
Mm-hmm. From Tim Naftali in New York to historian Tim Walz in Iowa City.
Just to cap on what Tim said, which is fantastic in terms of summing up the fact that we have become more conspiratorial as a result of our national security state. Not only did they not believe what the Warren Commission reported in 1964, they got out a quick report and it was disregarded, but the whole process went on over and over again in every decade. And as far as I recall, I think it was done in the 1990s to force agencies, National Security Agency, CIA, and so forth, to report, make copies of all the documents that they had related to the Kennedy assassination. And so there's another whole collection at the National Archives related to the Kennedy assassination just from 1990s. So it goes on and on and on. And in part, as Tim suggests, it's because we have so many secrets and Americans are uneasy about those secrets. As we know, we've had popular television shows that build on that whole premise.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we do. Let's listen to a 1995 episode of Unsolved Mysteries. You went to a place I really want to know because a lot of these conspiracy theories are not political theories, but we are sort of made to believe, or it's become entertainment, hasn't it?
Sure.
Comment on this after we hear this Unsolved Mysteries. It's a clip from Unsolved Mysteries. These are theories about UFOs and aliens surrounding Area 51. Let's listen.
UFOs have become the topics of everyday conversation. Yet a recent poll revealed that nearly half of all Americans now believe that UFOs are real. In the next hour, a new, in-depth look at what may be the most remarkable phenomenon of our age.
will take you to Area 51, a top-secret military installation tucked away in the remote Nevada desert.
Tim Walsh, tie in our entertainment, our conspiracy as entertainment into our political sphere.
This was a hugely popular show being hosted by Robert Stack. Some people will remember from the television show The Untouchables. But this revived and rehabilitated his career, his entertainment career. But again, that whole eerie music and that question about UFOs, and people might disregard that as kind of foolishness, but the government had a Project Blue Book, the Air Force, to investigate UFOs and what happened at Roswell and what happened, what are they doing in Area 51? But it speaks seriously to that question that Tim raised, that we have a national security state, that we have lots of secrets, that Americans want to know what the government knows. And that kind of leads to all kinds of wild theories and conspiracies in the process. So it's woven its way into our entertainment industry. Folks will remember, of course, X-Files. You know, the truth is out there, mm-hmm. but trust no one. I mean, it's contradictory oxymorons, but in effect, it becomes part of our culture.
Mm-hmm. Can I say something about Area 51 very quickly?
Yes, Tim, please.
It does involve secrecy and deception. Area 51 was where the CIA tested the U-2 spy plane. The U-2 spy plane was so important to eliminating concerns about the size of the Soviet bomber fleet in the 50s. And, of course, the U-2 spy plane is what gave John F. Kennedy the photographs of missiles in Cuba in 1962. In order that the Soviets would not know that the United States was developing a high-altitude spy plane, Americans were not told what was being tested. When Americans saw U-2s, which at that time were not painted black, they were silver, many Americans thought they saw a disc. It wasn't a disc, but they saw the silver. The U.S. Air Force, in support of the CIA, would meet the people that said they saw these things and then discourage them about what they saw. So there was deception. Now, it wasn't that there was an alien. But it was the fact that the U.S. did not want this secret military program or secret intelligence program to be known to the American people. So the unintended consequence of the spy plane program was the proliferation of theories about UFOs. Mm-hmm. That's why we had these. It was a product of a U.S. program, and it was an outcropping of the development of the national security state. And in the 1990s, a show like Stack's Unsolved Mysteries actually revived issues of Area 51 that go right back to the 40s, and it becomes a staple of assumptions about what our government has been doing without our knowing. Well, they were right. It was our government doing something we didn't know about, but it wasn't testing an ET. It was testing a high-altitude spy plane.
Mm-hmm. I mean, while we're on space flight or strange Area 51, we have, of course, the theory. We did, in fact, Americans did land for the first time in the history of humanity on the moon in 1969. But by the 70s, we have this bizarre conspiracy theory emerging that the moon landing never happened, Tim Walsh. Why would that take root?
Well, people had such a difficult time comprehending the science behind what NASA was doing, and that it just seemed unbelievable. And so what you have is somebody with a rich imagination saying that all of this was done in Hollywood on a sound stage, and that they created this. And again, I think it builds upon exactly what Tim has been talking about, and that is with the national security state, or the whole question of, can you trust your government? What is your government telling you, and is it possibly true? And all it takes is somebody with a pretty good-sized megaphone and some paranoia to create a sizable community, and it seems to spread like crabgrass in terms of popularity among the American people, in part because, of course, it's also encouraged on by shows like Unsolved Mysteries.
Is this Tim Naftali, is this a uniquely American thing? I know conspiracy theories exist in other countries, of course, but is our society especially open to it when we perhaps compare it to other countries? What are your thoughts?
It's not uniquely American, but because of the strength of our society, which I believe comes from its diversity, not all Americans have that same view of diversity. and in certainly in the 19th century, cultural differences gave rise to some conspiracy thinking. In the 20th century, because we're a superpower, and because the field of our secret activity is so much broader than it is in most any other democracy, save for arguably Great Britain, that has actually given, I think, given the United States or Americans a little bit more to be concerned about. I would argue one other piece, which we haven't mentioned, money. People have made money off of conspiracy theories.
Alex Jones is one we could mention there, too. How much damage has he done to the families of those who already lost their young children in that mass shooting? But we also have both of you very, very up on the Watergate era. Sometimes conspiracies are real. The Watergate break-in is a good example of a conspiracy that actually happened, Tim Walsh.
Absolutely, and I have to defer to Tim Naftali talk about Watergate, because nobody that I know has spent as much time thinking about and exploring and researching the evolution of Watergate as a concept, as a theory, and as a fact-based event.
Tim Naftali, early on, I wonder if after the first news broke of the break-in at the Watergate, was there a sense, perhaps for a while, that this is just some unfounded conspiracy?
Well, indeed, most of the prestige press did not pick up the story. It took two untested journalists named Woodward and Bernstein to keep at it. They were at the Washington Post at the time. And in fact, there wasn't a national sense of conspiracy just after Watergate. It seemed too absurd to associate with the Nixon White House. That thinking, of course, would change within a year. Yes, there have been conspiracies, and we have to keep those in mind. The assassination of Abraham Lincoln was part of a conspiracy to decapitate the entire federal government. There was certainly Watergate, which was a conspiracy. Iran-Contra involved a conspiracy during the Reagan administration. So there have been conspiracies, and one of the challenges is to differentiate between real and imagined conspiracies.
Let's bring it up in the final few minutes to the present time. Tim Walsh, let me start with you. Tie what we've been talking about in history into the current times and our openness to misinformation, how this has been so potently used by those who seek power.
Well, it's certainly the case, for example, with the spread of social media and multiple platforms and megaphones for people to build an audience. And the shock that draws listeners makes individuals more powerful, and it also brings in money, as Tim suggests. But it also then helps to groom candidates for office who use conspiracy theories to build and affect a voter base. And even if that voter base isn't the majority, it gives them a sense of power moving forward, and they become disruptors. It's not as if they necessarily change the election results in the end, but because they begin the whole process of trying to litigate a change, that it leads to friction and tension and, you know, multiple conspiracies. So that's what you have with election deniers, is just disruption.
Mm-hmm. Tim Naftali, do you believe that the election deniers who ran for office or perhaps succeeded in winning office or retaining office, were they along for the ride, not really believing in these conspiracy theories of baseless election fraud?
We'll see soon in how they act. But I just wanted to mention that one other source of conspiracy theories comes from abroad. Foreign governments have attempted to encourage some conspiracy theories that are helpful to their own cause. The Nazis in 1940 were doing what they could to spread misinformation and disinformation about Franklin Roosevelt to encourage the Republicans to nominate an isolationist candidate for president. In the end, actually, the Republicans nominated an interventionist. The Russians, the Soviets in the Cold War tried their best to spread disinformation to undermine our government. The Russians spread disinformation about the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Yeah.
The Soviets saw fractures in our society and tried to deepen them where they were useful to them. of course, the Russians would do this again in 2016.
In the final minute here, Tim Walsh, what does history tell us about remedies? What can individuals do to ward off baseless conspiracy theories, keep them from spreading?
Well, freedom of speech is a precious commodity, and I would urge everyone not to give in to emotion, but to use ration and critical thinking to determine the truth of what they're hearing, because I don't think there's ever going to be an end to the number of conspiracy theories and wacky ideas out there, but there can be an improvement in the quality of education so that people make a better assessment of what they're learning and hearing.
Okay, thank you very much for joining us, presidential historians Tim Walsh and Tim Naftali. Tim in New York, thank you so much for taking time in your day. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Tim.
Good to hear you, Tim.
Tim Walsh, of course, thank you for coming into our Iowa City studio today. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Ben.
Today's River to River, in fact, this is no conspiracy, produced by Caitlin Troutman with help from Natalie Dunlap. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Join us again tomorrow.